Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Practical Cloud Security, a guide for secure design and deployment, second edition, by Chris Dotson. Narrated by Stephen Caffrey. Publisher's note: this audiobook has bonus material. Please contact whomever you purchase this audiobook from to request the material. All figures referenced in this audiobook and the appendix, exercise solutions, can be found in the bonus material. Limit of liability, disclaimer of warranty. The views expressed in this work are those of the author and do not represent the publisher's views. While the publisher and the author have used good faith efforts to ensure that the information and instructions contained in this work are accurate, the publisher and the author disclaim all responsibility for errors or omissions, including, without limitation, responsibility for damages resulting from the use of or reliance on this work. Use of the information and instructions contained in this work is at your own risk. If any code samples or other technology this work contains or describes is subject to open source licenses or the intellectual property rights of others, it is your responsibility to ensure that your use thereof complies with such licenses and/or rights. Preface. As the title states, this book is a practical guide to securing your cloud environments. In almost all organizations, security has to fight for time and funding, and it often takes a back seat to implementing features and functions. Focusing on the best bang for the buck security-wise is important. This book is intended to help you get the most important security controls for your most important assets in place quickly and correctly, whether you're a security professional who is somewhat new to the cloud, or an architect or developer with security responsibilities. From that solid base, you can continue to build and mature your controls. While many of the security controls and principles are similar in cloud and on-premises environments, there are some important practical differences. For that reason, a few of the recommendations for practical cloud security may be surprising to those with an on-premises security background. While there are certainly legitimate differences of opinion among security professionals in almost any area of information security, the recommendations in this book stem from years of experience in securing cloud environments, and they are informed by some of the latest developments in cloud computing offerings. This is primarily a book about security, not compliance. That said, if you need to meet specific compliance requirements, such as PCI, DSS, HIPAA, or FedRAMP, you will find some limited guidance on designing your security controls so that you will be able to do so. Who should listen to this book? This book is designed as an intermediate-level resource and is intended primarily for two types of practitioners: those who have some experience with securing on-premises environments, but little or no experience with cloud environments; those who have experience building cloud environments, but little or no experience with securing those cloud environments. The goal of this book is to provide a conceptual level understanding of the art of the possible in cloud security. You won't find a cookbook-style guide on exactly how to implement various controls in specific cloud environments for a few reasons. One is that such guides tend to become out of date very quickly, because cloud providers are constantly improving their implementations. Another is that the cloud providers generally do a better job of providing explicit how-to guides than I can, because the implementations are specific to the way they've designed their services. A detailed how-to guide by one cloud provider will be more useful than a generic how-to that tries to cover multiple cloud providers. What I try to provide is the understanding of when you need to find such a guide and use it. Navigating this book. The first three chapters deal with understanding your responsibilities in the cloud and how they differ from those in on-premises environments, as well as understanding what assets you have, what the most likely threats to those assets are, and some protections for them. Chapters 4 through 6 provide practical guidance, in priority order, of the most important security controls that you should consider first. Identity and access management, vulnerability management, network controls. The final chapter deals with how to detect when something's wrong and deal with it. It's a good idea to listen to this chapter before something actually goes wrong. What's new in the second edition? This new edition has been updated based on developments in the cloud computing and security industries in the years since the release of the first edition. Some examples are more information on zero trust principles as they apply to protecting cloud environments, advancements in encryption techniques, such as quantum-resistant encryption algorithms, advancements in authentication techniques, such as passwordless technologies and passkeys, the use of privileged access management tools to protect cloud environments, verification of workload identities, in addition to human identities, the importance of protecting software supply chains, including build and deployment environments in the cloud, with transparency through a software bill of materials, SBOM. Updates based on changes to offerings by major cloud providers since the previous publication. Updated examples of the different types of defensive tools and technologies available today. In addition, you can now check your newfound understanding of cloud security concepts as you listen. I have added some questions and exercises to the end of each chapter, and the answers are in the appendix, which can be found in the bonus material of this book. O'Reilly Online Learning Platform. O'Reilly. For almost 40 years, O'Reilly Media has provided technology and business training, knowledge and insight to help companies succeed. Our unique network of experts and innovators share their knowledge and expertise through books, articles, conferences, and our online learning platform. O'Reilly's online learning platform gives you on-demand access to live training courses, in-depth learning paths, interactive coding environments, and a vast collection of text and video from O'Reilly and 200-plus other publishers. For more information, please visit O'Reilly.com. Chapter 1. Principles and Concepts. Yes, this is a practical guide, but we do need to cover a few cloud-relevant security principles and concepts at a high level before we dive into the practical bits. If you're a seasoned security professional but new to the cloud, you may want to skim down to the cloud shared responsibility model. The reason for covering these principles and concepts first is because they are used implicitly throughout the rest of the book when I discuss designing and implementing security controls to stop attackers. Conceptual gaps and misunderstandings in security can cause lots of issues. For example, if you're not familiar with least privilege, you may understand authorization for cloud services well, but still grant too much access to people or automation in your cloud account or on a cloud database with sensitive information. If you're not familiar with defense in depth, then having multiple layers of authentication, network access control, or encryption may not seem useful. If you don't know a little about threat modeling, the likely motivations of attackers, and the trust boundaries of the system that you're designing, you may be spending time and effort protecting the wrong things. If you don't understand the cloud service delivery models and the shared responsibility model, you may spend time worrying about risks that are your cloud provider's responsibility and miss risks that are your responsibility to address. If you don't know a little about risk management, you may spend too much time and effort on low risks rather than managing your higher risks. I'll cover this foundational information quickly so that we can get to cloud security controls. Least privilege. The principle of least privilege simply states that people or automated tools should be able to access only what they need to do their jobs, and no more. It's easy to forget the automation part of this. For example, a component accessing a database should not use credentials that allow write access to the database if write access isn't needed. A practical application of least privilege often means that your access policies are deny by default. That is, users are granted no, or very few, privileges by default, and they need to go through the request and approval process for any privileges they require. For cloud environments, some of your administrators will need to have access to the cloud console, a web page that allows you to create, modify, and destroy cloud assets such as virtual machines. With many providers, anyone with access to your cloud console will have godlike privileges by default for everything managed by that cloud provider. This might include the ability to read, modify, or destroy data from any part of the cloud environment, regardless of what controls are in place on the operating systems of the provisioned systems. For this reason, you need to tightly control access to and privileges on the cloud console, much as you tightly control physical data center access in on-premises environments and record what these users are doing. Defense in depth. Many of the controls in this book, if implemented correctly, would negate the need for other controls. Defense in depth is an acknowledgement that almost any security control can fail, either because an attacker is sufficiently determined and skilled, or because of a problem with the way that security control is implemented. With defense in depth, you create multiple layers of overlapping security controls so that if one fails, the one behind it can still catch the attackers. You can certainly go to silly extremes with defense in depth, which is why it's important to understand the threats you're likely to face. However, as a general rule, you should be able to point to any single security control you have and say, "What if this fails?" If the answer is unacceptable, you probably have insufficient defense in depth. You may also have insufficient defense in depth if a single failure can make several of your security controls ineffective, such as an inventory issue that causes multiple tools to miss a problem. Zero Trust. Many products and services today claim to be zero trust or to support zero trust principles. The name is confusing because zero trust does not mean a complete lack of trust in anything, and the confusion is worse because it's used for so many different marketing purposes. There are many different definitions and different ideas about what is meant by zero trust. We are probably stuck with the term at this point, but zero trust should really be called something else, such as zero implicit trust or zero assumed trust without a good reason. If you're expecting tips on how to pick catchy marketing names, you're probably listening to the wrong book. The core principle is that trust from a user or another system should be earned, rather than given simply because the user is able to reach you on a network, or has a company-owned device, or some other criterion that's not well controlled. The implementation of zero trust will differ widely depending on whether you're talking about trusting devices, network connections, or something else. One commonly used implementation of zero trust is requiring encryption and authentication for all connections, even ones that originate and terminate in supposedly trusted networks. This was always a good idea, but it's even more important in cloud environments where the perimeter is less strictly designed and internet connectivity is easy. Another common implementation of zero trust principles is limiting users' network access to only the applications that they need, challenging the implicit trust that all users should be able to connect to all applications, even if they cannot log in. If you think this sounds a lot like least privilege and defense in depth, you're right. There is considerable overlap between zero trust principles and some of the other principles in this chapter. A third example of zero trust is the use of multi-factor authentication of users, with re-authentication required either periodically or when higher risk transactions are requested. In this case, we're challenging the implicit trust that whoever has the password for an account or controls a particular session for an application is the intended user. When following zero trust principles, you should only trust an interaction if you have strong evidence that the trust is warranted, such as by proof of strong authentication or authorization or correct configuration. That evidence should either be from something you directly control, such as your own authentication system or device management system, or from some third party that you have explicitly evaluated as competent to make trust decisions for you. Like other principles in this chapter, it can be disruptive to the user experience if taken to extremes. Threat actors, diagrams, and trust boundaries. There are different ways to think about your risks, but I typically favor an asset-oriented approach. This means that you concentrate first on what you need to protect, which is why I dig into data assets first in Chapter 2. It's also a good idea to keep in mind who is most likely to cause you problems. In cybersecurity parlance, these are your potential threat actors. For example, you may not need to guard against a well-funded state actor, but you might be in a business where a cyber criminal can make money by stealing your data, or where a hacktivist might want to deface your website for political or social reasons. Keep these people in mind when designing all your defenses. While there is plenty of information and discussion available on the subject of threat actors, motivations, and methods, in this book, we'll consider four main types of threat actors that you may need to worry about. Organized crime or independent criminals interested primarily in making money. Hacktivists interested primarily in discrediting you by releasing stolen data, committing acts of vandalism, or disrupting your business. Inside attackers usually interested in discrediting you or making money. State actors who may be interested in stealing secrets or disrupting your business to advance a foreign government's political mission or cause. The Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report is an excellent free resource for understanding different types of successful attacks organized by industry and methods, and the executive summary is very readable. To borrow a technique from the world of user experience design, you may want to imagine a member of each applicable group, give them a name, jot down a little about that persona on a card, and keep the cards visible when designing your defenses. The second thing you have to do is figure out what needs to talk to what in your application, and the easiest way to do that is to draw a picture and figure out where your weak spots are likely to be. There are entire books on how to do this, but you don't need to be an expert to draw something useful enough to help you make decisions. I recommend Threat Modeling, Designing for Security by Adam Shostak. However, if you are in a high-risk environment, you should probably create formal diagrams with a suitable tool rather than draw stick figures. Although there are many different application architectures, for the sample application used for illustration here, I will show a simple three-tier design. Here is what I recommend for a very simple application component diagram. 1. Draw a stick figure and label it User. Draw another stick figure and label it Administrator. Figure 1-1, which can be found in the bonus material for this book. You may find later that you have multiple types of users and administrators or other roles, but this is a good start. 2. Draw a box for the first component the user talks to. For example, the web servers. Draw a line from the user to that first component and label the line with how the user talks to that component. Figure 1-2. Note that at this point, the component may be a serverless function, a container, a virtual machine, or something else. This will let anyone talk to it, so it will probably be the first thing attacked. We really don't want the other components trusting this one more than necessary. 3. Draw other boxes behind the first for all of the other components that first system has to talk to, and draw lines going to those. Figure 1-3. Whenever you get to a system that actually stores data, draw a little symbol. I use a cylinder next to it and jot down what data is there. Keep going until you can't think of any more boxes to draw for your application. 4. Now draw how the administrator, or any other roles you've defined, accesses the application. Note that the administrator may have several different ways of talking to this application. For example, via the cloud provider's portal or APIs, or through the operating system, or in a manner similar to how a user accesses it. Figure 1-4. 5. Draw some trust boundaries as dotted lines around the boxes. Figure 1-5. A trust boundary means that anything inside that boundary can be at least somewhat confident of the motives of anything else inside that boundary, but requires verification before trusting anything outside of the boundary. The idea is that if an attacker gets into one part of the trust boundary, it's reasonable to assume they'll eventually have complete control over everything in it. So getting through each trust boundary should take some effort. Note that I drew multiple web servers inside the same trust boundary. That means it's okay for these web servers to trust each other. And if someone has access to one, they effectively have access to all. Or, to put it another way, if someone compromises one of these web servers, no further damage will be done by having them all compromised. In this context, zero trust principles lead us to reduce these trust boundaries to the smallest reasonable size. For example, a single component, which here might be an individual server or a cluster of servers with the same data and purpose. 6. To some extent, we trust our entire system more than the rest of the world. So draw a dotted line around all of the boxes, including the admin, but not the user. Figure 1-6. Note that if you have multiple admins, like a web server admin and a database admin, they might be in different trust boundaries. The fact that there are trust boundaries inside of trust boundaries shows the different levels of trust. For example, the servers here may be willing to accept network connections from servers in other trust boundaries inside the application, but still verify their identities. On the other hand, they may not be willing to accept connections from systems outside of the whole application trust boundary. We'll use this diagram of an example application throughout the book when discussing the shared responsibility model, asset inventory, controls, and monitoring. Right now, there are no cloud-specific controls shown in the diagram, but that will change as we progress through the chapters. Look at any place a line crosses a trust boundary. These are the places we need to focus on securing first. Cloud service delivery models. There is an unwritten law that no book on cloud computing is complete without an overview of infrastructure as a service, IaaS, platform as a service, PaaS, and software as a service, SaaS. Rather than give the standard overview, I'd like to quickly say that IaaS services typically allow you to create virtual computers, storage, and networks. PaaS services are typically higher-level services, such as databases that enable you to build applications. And SaaS services are applications used by end users. You can find many expanded definitions and subdivisions of these categories, but these are the core definitions. These service models are useful only for a general understanding of concepts. In particular, the line between IaaS and PaaS is becoming increasingly blurred. Is a content delivery network service that caches information for you around the internet to keep it close to users, a PaaS or an IaaS? It doesn't really matter. What's important is that you understand what is and isn't provided by the service, not whether it fits neatly into any particular category. The Cloud Shared Responsibility Model. The most basic security question you must answer is, what aspects of security am I responsible for?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?